Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, across the world and the universe. Welcome to my Quantum Living Podcast, at the intersection of science and spirituality. I'm your host, Anna Anderson. An inquisitive soul on a lifetime mission to find out how life really works. This podcast is about bringing the spiritual, metaphysical, and esoteric concepts down to the practical level, so that we can learn and apply them in our daily life to make it a little easier and raise our consciousness to the next level. Whether you are listening to this show while driving or commuting, doing chores around the house, relaxing on a couch, or flying in a spaceship across the galaxy, I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. Okay, let's begin. Hello and welcome back to Quantum Living. We have talked on this podcast about the science of intuition, a new science of the afterlife, real magic and the future of science, and the science of channeling. So today's episode, The Science of Love, is yet another perfect topic, bridging science and spirituality, that I love to explore. Why? Because now, this is the new way of living and engaging with life and this world, where we do need scientific validation of what ancient esoteric wisdom has been revealing and teaching us for thousands of years. Everything is coming together, like multiple images split by a prism and moving slowly to the center, where they form just one crystal clear and sharp picture of our reality we call life. We are one. And in order to progress to the next level of consciousness as human beings, we must understand and embrace this key universal principle. So, if we are one, yet so many individual consciousnesses, from minerals to plants, animals, and humans, having all different life experiences, you might ask, what keeps us interconnected? What's the glue? The common denominator we can always call upon when everything else fails? The answer is love. In all its spiritual and scientific dimensions and meanings, we will explore in this episode. My special guest today is someone well known in both the scientific and spiritual circles, whose work is instrumental in raising consciousness on this planet in a very practical way. I wanted to have this guest on my show for a long time, and so I'm thrilled that I can introduce him to you today, Dr. Rolin McCrady. Rolin McCrady, PhD, is Director of Research at the HeartMath Research Center of the HeartMath Institute. As a psychophysiologist, Dr. McCrady's research interests include the physiology of emotion, heart-brain communication, and the global interconnectivity between people and the Earth's magnetic systems. Findings from his research have been widely applied to the development of tools and technology to optimize individual and organizational health, performance, and quality of life. You will find more information about Dr. McCrady and his work on my podcast website at quantumlivingpodcast.com. Hello, Rolin. Welcome to Quantum Living. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, hello, Anna. It's great to be here with you.
Oh, I'm so excited to be able to speak with you today. And I have so many questions and I would like to talk about so much. So let's see how much we can fit into into an hour or so of this podcast. Could you please briefly share with us your personal journey that has brought you to this point? Was it a journey of the heart?
Wow. Ultimately, I would say yes. And I think I've always, without knowing it for a long period of my early life, was following my heart without really knowing that I was doing that. I mean, I'd always had a deeper sense, but of an inner guidance, I guess you could say. So I came into the planet this time around, I think, with a pretty deep curiosity and sense of adventure. As a lot of us do, I guess. But my first career was electrical engineering. I was a communication engineer. I used to work for Motorola, so know, using radio waves to communicate, you know, professionally. And I won't go into a lot there, but I always had a deeper curiosity, you know, and I would ask, you know, professors and teachers and along the way, well, what is a magnetic field or a gravitational field, et cetera? And, you know, I'd always get the answer back, well, here's the formula, da, 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 da. No, I that describes its behavior. I'm asking you, what is it? And would always kind of get, you know, more, they wouldn't say it this way, but it was basically, don't ask that, go away. Well, it's true. I mean, and that's still, I think, true largely, to really understand what these things, if their real core essence actually are. And, you know, we know a lot about how they behave and in electromagnetics, how to use them. That's all of our technology is based on this stuff now, but that still doesn't mean we know what the heck's on the other side of things. But anyway, that curiosity led me, I don't know, I'm going back to the 1970s now. I found a book in a bookstore, actually at the University of Nebraska, is where I was at that time, that was my introduction into consciousness, you know, and it was a book on radionics, actually, and it had some interesting perspectives that, I'll just say intuitively, made a lot of sense to me. Long story short, I packed up my tools so I could kind of work anywhere in the world, you know, and moved to California to get a degree in consciousness studies.
Wow.
Now, this is back in the 70s, right? So this is one of the first now you can get, you know, almost anywhere and find the study of consciousness or not, well, a lot of places anyway. It wasn't the case then. And so it was one of the first, you know, official accredited degree granting places that you could study these kinds of things. So I did that. And then through that, again, trying to make this a longer story, much shorter here, got involved through that work and the people I met there in introducing spirulina to the world. We're the first to do that, at least in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the motive behind that was to feed the world's hungry populations, you know, spirulina being a food you could actually live on if you had to and had all the, anyway, that's an ancient times ago. And so I wasn't the founder of it, but ran one of the companies, you know, started it and ran it that sold the spirulina through health food stores and so on. And then another division did a multi-level thing. And, you know, we were doing pretty good. You know, we were running along in sales at probably 150,000 U.S. I'm talking now a month, and which is not bad for, you know, selling green algae that nobody ever heard of. but the National Enquirer, which is a grocery store magazine, I don't know if you have those there for you, I don't know, did a front page cover. This was in the very early 80s. I'll never forget the title of it. It's one of those few things I remember from that era, but to doctors praise safe new diet pill, lose weight and never be hungry again. In the next 2 weeks in my division, I sold about $20 million of spirulina.
Wow.
And the power, at least back then, of these supermarket, you know, rag magazines, as they're called here.
Wow.
That was amazing. And that's a whole sub-story that I won't go into how we pulled that off, but basically we took the profits of that. The real story I want to get to went to the Southern California out in the desert to prove that you could go to anywhere in the world in the deserts of the world and grow spirulina and feed people, right? Kind of way ahead of our time in a way. You know, we were using solar power, these big three-story spray dryers and spirulina farm, and we actually did it, pulled it off. We were growing spirulina and it, long story short though, it went nowhere in terms of feeding people. It wasn't because we didn't have the technology. In hindsight, Anna, this is what I now would say, this is when my idealism bubble got popped, right? You know, you're idealistic. Yeah, we'll go invent this stuff and be able to feed the world and it'll happen, right? But it was the bureaucracy, the governments, people didn't want people fed in certain countries, you know, on and on and on it went. So, you know, meanwhile, you know, I've got a degree in consciousness studies, right? I've learned about meditation and, you know, and the heart, supposedly, later to find I didn't know anything at all about consciousness and the heart. So long story short, I decided to, the heck with this humanitarian nonsense. I'm going to go make money again. So I started a company which became very successful in a fairly short time period. Don't get me wrong, I had a great time. I mean, it was fun having a rapidly growing company and offices around the world and this and that and traveling all the time. But there came a point a few years into that, that my heart was still there, kind of nudging me of saying, okay, is another sports car in the driveway really going to fulfill you? Is it really going to connect you with that deeper mission that I had felt from very early childhood? And of course it wasn't. And through some other friends, I met this guy I'd been hearing about, Doc Childry, who's the founder of HeartMath. So I decided that he was living on the East Coast at that time, and I had business back there. I figured, I'll go meet this character and spend an hour or two and see what this is all about. Ended up staying 3 days. And it was there that, through that meeting, and I would say in looking back on it, he facilitated a real heart, my first true heart awakening, where I was really lifted into another domain of consciousness and connecting with my own larger self. You know, so a lot of things become very clear in that connection and that download. So basically, I sold the company and joined with some others that had similar backgrounds to mine, been successful in their careers, but were looking at that next level of growth spiritually, and helped him found HeartMath.
So it was a journey of the heart, as I said.
It was.
As I suspected.
Well, and that was definitely a heart decision, because, you know, after that experience and starting to, you know, I mean, I always like to say this, because I had, you know, this degree in consciousness and we studied, you know, the idea of the heart and blah, 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 blah. But in reality, it's usually kind of written off as that's a metaphor. You know, this heart, mushy heart stuff. No, it's about the brain. Come on. But that was in that awakening process, initial step in the awakening process, to be more clear there, is where I realized, no, this heart stuff is real. This is not a metaphor. And this is a completely different doorway into connecting with, you know, raising our vibration and connecting with our, here at HeartMath, we just call it your larger self, but you can call it your higher self, you know, God within, the spirit, soul, whatever language and culture you're from.
Yes, thank you for sharing. And I'm not surprised that your journey was or has been along these lines and so connected to the heart, to the original calling of your heart. Now, your work at the HeartMath Institute is so broad and so interesting, and I'll just invite my listeners to visit your website and peruse and get more information. And we'll talk about all this in a moment. We could take this conversation into so many directions, but I'd like to focus on the heart-brain connection, the science of love, and the heart as the portal to our intuition, higher self, and the soul that you have mentioned.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So we talk about our heart all the time, more often than about any other organs in the body. We have heart-to-heart talks. We take things to heart. Our heart goes out to someone in distress. Someone has no heart when treating others badly. Something or someone can break our heart. We pray from the heart. The news can be heart-wrenching. We look into our heart for answers. And of course, the heart is the seat and symbol of love. We certainly don't pay so much attention to our liver or kidneys. Maybe we should, for different reasons. So let's start our conversation with your seminal work on the heart-brain coherence, which is what the HeartMath Institute is probably best known of. Could you please explain from the scientific, psychophysiological point of view, and obviously spiritual, what is it and how it works, and why is it so critically important?
Sure. Got to dial back quite a few years here in some of our original work. Well, first of all, let's start with the heart and brain are more interconnected through our nervous system than any other systems in the body. You know, I had to laugh to myself just a little bit off topic when you were reading out that list of heart, thinking that I don't know anybody who has said, I love you with all my brain, you know, when they were proposing to their spouse or, so we intuitively know that, and all the things you shared, there's something deeper about the heart than just a pump. And in fact, that's the heart's probably not even actually a pump, but that's a whole other story we won't get into. But the dirty secret, you know, that's kind of well known, but ignored. But the heart through the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, sends far more information to the brain than the other way around. This was kind of known in the founding fathers of psychology, William James, these type of people. They talked about the heart changing first and then feeling and these types of things. And a lot of modern scientists haven't really read their work and kind of rounded it off and didn't understand the depth of what they really knew and understood back then. And so that was really kind of the basis of psychology from the mid-1880s till the 1930s. And then it all became about the brain. And to keep in mind, this is about the same time period that the first hormone was being discovered. I mean, we really knew very little about the brain, the nervous system, hormones, all of this was. And then this is where the fight-flight response came out of this work around this same era. And the idea that basically it was all about the brain, and it couldn't be this heart stuff because it was too slow, and all the stuff that they just made a lot of mistakes in hindsight. And it all became about the brain, right? And a lot of the knowledge from earlier years was really forgotten. And so there's been a fair amount of rediscovery that's had to go on. And the pendulum shifted back, scientifically speaking, now in my community, psychophysiology, beginning in the 1970s, when a particular research group called the Lacys, it was a husband and wife team, challenged that paradigm when their research, let me back up a little bit here, Anna, because at that time, it was sort of believed that, actually people believed this then, that it was all about the brain, and that if you could, you know, give the brain the blood and oxygen and all that it needed, and you could, basically could, without the body, it would be just fine. Nobody believes that now, but that was kind of the paradigm of the day, right? And the autonomic nervous system was this kind of dumb thing that was like wires that the brain used to tell the body what to do, right? Well, the Lacys came along and showed that, well, no, that's not quite the way, when you really look at the way the brain, heart, body is working, that it actually is reflecting. So what their first experiment showed, that the brain might be sending more signals down, say, the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, and heart rate should speed up, right? Like doing what it's told. But it didn't always. Sometimes the heart rate would slow down, and vice versa. You could have signals telling the heart to slow down on the parasympathetic system, and it would speed up. And in fact, reading the research literature of that era, they were using phrases in their, you know, published journal articles like, the heart acts like it has a mind of its own, right? And of course, this was not popular because it was challenging the paradigm. You know, paradigms don't like to be challenged of any era. But they ended up winning many career awards and, you know, all kinds of things. Because not only that, they looked at the other side of this equation, which is called in neuroscience, the afferent, which means ascending signals from the heart to the brain, that the messages that the heart was sending to the brain, the brain obeyed, and that they had profound influences on our perception, how we're perceiving the world. Well, we took a little bit farther, their work, into even emotional experience. Like, why do we put our hands on our heart, you know, when we feel something, right? There's a reason for that. Not only that, now they didn't make a big deal out of this back then, but we have since, but their data was actually showing that not only was all those things I just said true, but the heart somehow knew ahead of time what the brain needed to do next and was preparing the brain for its next activity performance-wise. That would have been too far out to, I mean, even though it was clearly in their data, that you get little baby mentions of it when you read their stuff carefully. But then we've taken that on into our work on intuition, but that's another story we might have time to get to today or not. But anyway, that's the basics of that. Now, it took other research groups, the Lacys, in terms of the mechanism, I mean, they were very famous because they were the first to put a formal hypothesis, which is that the heart has a causal role in modulating human perception. Okay, so that was their big hypothesis. Now, the mechanisms they didn't have all completely correct, and it took other labs and research groups over the years, and including ours to some degree, to really sort out all the mechanisms of that, which we know very clearly now. And it's pretty simple at the end of the day. Now, part of that story, and this really began, I would say, from a research perspective in the early 1990s, is the field that emerged called neurocardiology. And this is there are neurocardiology groups, you know, all around the world now. There are textbooks on it. There are conferences. I mean, it's a very well-established field. And in 1992, I think, kind of one of the founding, he's now retired, but neurocardiologist, a guy named John Andrew Armour, that coined the nickname heart brain. Now, technically, that's called the intrinsic cardiac nervous system. So neurocardiology is the study of the brain or the neural system within the human heart, or an animal hearts too, but that. So that helped resolve one of the mysteries, like how the heart acts like it has a mind of its own. Well, it actually does. The heart does have its own brain, and it is connecting with the brain in our head, sending more information to the brain upstairs than the other way around, as I mentioned earlier.
Something has just occurred to me as you were speaking about what is more important, or who is the boss, put it this way. Is it the brain or the heart? And what has just occurred to me is that the heart can live for a period of time outside of the body. Hence, we do heart transplants. And as far as I know, the brain cannot live outside the body. Is it true?
Well, that would be true. I mean, the brain can't live without the heart. You mean perfusion, you know? Yeah. But that's true. I mean, I thought where you might gonna be go with that, I hear a lot of people talk about, is when we're embryos, that the heart is the first system to develop in the embryo. It's the first organ, and quite several weeks before our brain starts to develop. In fact, we now know that the neural structures and what we now call the intrinsic cardiac nervous system form there in the heart first, and then migrate through what's called the neural tube to become the brain. So even in embryosis, the heart's the first. And if that heartbeat, that first electrical signal, the first what you could detect as a heartbeat, electrically speaking, doesn't happen, the fetus spontaneously aborts. I went down this lane, so I'll finish the story here. Things called a cardiac monster. Okay, it's I forget now. It's like one in every 500,000 births or something like that. It's fairly rare, but it does happen. So for most, a fairly high percent of pregnancies, the woman never knows she was pregnant. And if that heartbeat doesn't happen, then you spontaneously abort, and you never even know that this was all going on. Now, in some cases, that abortion signal doesn't happen, and the fetus continues to develop without that heartbeat. But this is why it's called an acardiac, A meaning no heart, a cardiac monster. Then you get a dead, basically, clump. You know, it just keeps growing, but you'll have an arm sticking out one side and an eye over there and a foot sticking out, you know, no shape, human being.
No life in it.
Not only no life, but no structure. It's just a clump. It looks nothing like a person.
Wow.
Right? You'd have, like I said, a foot sticking out one side and an eyeball the other. I mean, there's no, and the implication here is it's that field from the heart that guides differentiation of all the cells, that guides them into where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to be to create, you know, it's called morphogenesis in the old days. Of that guiding signal. So anyway, that's a very kind of off topic in a certain way.
Well, no, it's very much on topic. I wasn't aware of that up until now, and it is really interesting. And it does make sense.
Yeah.
It does make sense because it confirms in my mind that the heart is the portal to our spiritual self. So as we know, or most people would know these days, would understand that we are multidimensional beings. So let's talk for a moment about the heart as a portal to our intuition, higher self, and the soul, again, whatever language people choose to use.
Mm-hmm.
I know, for example, that my heart can sense the future, which you mentioned that this has been observed. So we can tune into the quantum field to receive information. And I suspect that together with the pineal gland, which is also considered a portal to other dimensions, other realities, it is our heart that expands its electromagnetic field, which we haven't mentioned yet, tuning into the information in the quantum field and then bringing this information to us. The tricky part is for us to being able to interpret this information. And I feel that if we could develop our intuition, our sixth sense, which is the sensitivity to the information in the quantum field, which is always there, we could learn to interpret, to learn to decipher it. Would you agree?
Mostly. But can I offer a different perspective? That's,
sure.
That's, I think, well aligned with what you're saying, Anna. Let me start here by now. Some of this, what I'm about to share, I've got to be careful here. I'll let you know when I take my science hat off.
Sure. Yeah.
And when what we can prove in the lab and what I have to share from my own personal experience and that of many others. So I'm going to suggest we have two hearts, the physical heart and what we call the energetic heart here at HeartMath. It's also been called the spiritual heart in many, spiritual traditions, mm-hmm. as well for thousands of years, especially the Islamic traditions and some of the Buddhist and Eastern traditions as well. So what I'm suggesting here, and I'll tell you about the experiments, the way I can say this in addition to my own inner experience, is that the energetic heart is very real. It is not a metaphor. It's complex and it has its own structure. And I completely agree with what you said in that we are multidimensional beings. So at the energetic level, if I can say that, the part of our undivided wholeness that we can't put under a microscope yet anyway, you can't put a thought under a microscope or an emotion or an intuition, right? You can only measure the physiological changes that co-vary with those experiences, which we can do very, very good. We're very good at. But so the energetic heart, I'm suggesting, is the bridge to your larger self or your higher self or your soul, spirit, whatever you want to call it. But this is the anatomy of how we're actually wired, energetically speaking. This is not a metaphor. And at the energetic heart level, it's in communication with all the DNA. It is where the real blueprint for who we really are exists at. I mean, yes, in our DNA at the cell level is your eye color and you're going to be a boy or a girl and haircut, those kinds of things. But when we're talking about finding your who you really are, it's your higher vibrational self and our real true purpose. You have to go through that bridge to the larger self. And that's why the heart, as you mentioned, is in so many traditions forever been, the heart's the seat of wisdom and, spirituality and all these things, love especially. So one of the things that we have heard forever and still to this day from the many thousands of people who practice HeartMath skills and techniques, and use the technologies to shift into a heart coherent, what we call a heart coherent state that you can measure and practice, is that their intuition is noticeably different. It's like, I've heard the term, God, my intuition's on steroids from some, hundreds of people. This is a very common, one of the most common things we hear. And then the second thing is usually in synchronicities have become a way of life. So that we figured out a way to do some very rigorous, I won't go into all the scientific detail. It's all published in peer-reviewed journal articles and things. lab-based studies on intuition, right? Can we measure this, right? And this is some, I think, some of the best data that I'm about to share with you that supports what I just said about the heart being a portal or a bridge to our larger self. So it's not some big one quantum field in my perspective. It is our own larger self. It's part of our undivided wholeness. I mean, my larger self is my larger self. Yours is yours, and so on. And it's kind of, we keep cycling through Earth in our journey of the evolution of consciousness, you know, to wake up to who we really are ultimately. I mean, that's my way of thinking. Okay, so in our work on intuition, we've identified three types that I think is helpful to talk about first. And the first is called, I call it anyway, and I think most would agree in the scientific literature, implicit knowledge or implicit learning. And these are the type of intuition that's safe to do research on in academic circles. And because it's really all about, well, these are the types of things that implicit means that we don't have conscious access. It's a type of memory that we can't remember, but it's stored away unconsciously in the brain. So these are things that we've learned and forgot we learned. We may not have even realized we were learning it. You know, we watch people do things and, you know, this and that, and we're picking up things and learning. So the brain, it's called dual process theory in some circles, but it's where we encounter something and we somehow know the answer without knowing how we know it, right? But it's really all about the brain accessing these unconscious patterns. You know, the problem with it is it can also be wrong, right? Because the current event may not really be directly relevant to the past historical thing that we're pattern matching to or referencing to. But it's an important part of intuition. Like, it's also what leads to is often called expert knowledge. You know, there's many examples, but a classic one that a lot of people relate to is a nurse who's been around the block, you know, been a nurse for some years, right? Walks into a patient's room and says, oh, no, this patient's in trouble. They're going to code maybe in the next hour or so, right? And you have a new nurse that are with her going, well, how do you know that? She goes, I don't know. I just know it. But she's picking up. She's had enough experience that she's picking up something from that patient. It could be their skin color. I mean, who knows what it is that they've equated to that. They're in trouble. Okay, so enough said on that. We could spend a lot of time. But the second type I call energetic sensitivity. And now this is our nervous system's ability to detect and accurately respond to very typically real, often measurable signals from the environment. So I'm going to take a brief detour here because I'm going to put empathy in this category. So we know, and this is something else we could talk about if we have time, when the heart beats, we put electrodes on the body, we measure the electrical current flow. That's why it's called the electrocardiogram, right? But whenever that current flow happens, you create a magnetic field. Which the electrodes don't see, but that magnetic fields go through things. That's why cell phones work indoors, right? It's the magnetic component that goes through the walls and the windows. So the magnetic field of the heart radiates, you know, feet outside the body, and is carrying. We published a number of studies on this. Is carrying information about our emotional state. So what we feel inside, we are constantly broadcasting through our field radiations. So energetic sensitivity, we also know, and have also proven this, that our nervous system is, like I was saying, this big antenna that is receiving the information being carried by those fields from other people in measurable ways. That our body responds to the information from other people unconsciously. So that would be an example of energetic sensitivity. There are people who can feel earthquakes coming. Right, we now know we can measure changes in the Earth's field, the magnetic field of the Earth, before earthquakes. Right, that are associated with that earthquake. So this is their nervous system detecting that signal, and they've had enough experience to know, okay, that signal equals earthquake. Right? It's a real thing. It's a real capacity that people. And then the third type, which is where you were already going, is what we call non-local intuition, just because you can't write these kind off through the other two types. And it usually has to do with something in the future, you know, that you can't predict from past behavior or information or something far away, right? The mother knows their children or child is in harm's way or doing something they shouldn't be doing, and they could be on the other side of the planet or town. It doesn't matter. In that same category, which is a little bit different, and now because I can put, you know, our sensitivity to the information in the magnetic fields of the Earth, I can actually explain how that is a kind of a global information field in a way that can explain how moms know their kids are, you know, in harm's way on the other side of the planet without going to quantum fields or anything like that. But I'm also going to put in that same non-local category, that flow of information, which is the big game intuition, the kind of intuition we should all be trying to develop, the flow of information from our larger self, you know, through the energetic heart. That's really our inner guidance system. Because at the larger, the higher self level, that is outside of the time and space as we know it. So it already knows what our blueprint is and what our best next steps are. You know, it sees that has that more objective wholeness view, you know, and easily communicates with other beings and other, you know, other higher selves up there, other larger selves. And that's how it organizes synchronicities and things like that. But anyway, so how did we research that? I'm sorry for a long story to get there, but we spent a few years doing this kind of research and with different protocols and so on. And the first thing we did, the type of a protocol was having people at a computer, kind of like you and I are now. And we were wiring them all up to all these physiological measures, their EEG or brain waves, their electrocardiograms, skin conductance, these types of things. And they are sitting there at the screen, and there's a lot of trials is what we call them. You push a button. And meanwhile, all the data is being recorded, you know, the brain waves and the heartbeats and these types of things. And then sometime later, the computer then randomly selects an image it shows to the person. And the image can be from the two opposite ends of what's called the International Affective Picture Set. In other words, these are images that are well-researched to evoke different types of emotions and with different intensities of those emotions. We take the two extreme ends. So on one end, you've got, you know, bunny rabbits and flowers and nature scenes and things like that. On the other end, you've got a snake striking at the screen. I mean, it really kind of jar you if you're not expecting it, you know, or bad guys with knives at a woman's throat and, you know, just, you know, edgy, about as edgy as you can get them and feel okay showing them to somebody, to an adult. And long story short, what we found was that the heart is the first to receive the intuitive information about the future event. And the heart was always accurate, is the big player here of accurately predicting what that image is going to be. And there's a lot of controls that go in, so you can never guess. And the heart then sends measurably a different neural signal to the brain. We can measure that. We can trace that flow of ascending neural information through the nervous system to the brain, and both in time and location, how it's flowing through the brain. And that signal actually goes to the frontal cortex. Then you have a brain response in what we call the pre-stimulus period before you see the picture, and then a body response, the gut feeling, you know, in the gut or the hair on the back of the neck. So that's when, after you have the brain response and it triggers a stress response in the nervous system, that's when it becomes conscious for people. They feel it in the body. Because intuitions is always defined as a feeling, right? About something good or bad in the future. So the real flow of this intuitive information from our larger self is heart, brain, body, conscious awareness, if you're paying attention to what you're feeling.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So I'm not so sure the pineal gland and all that. It's really the heart, you know, that's where the signal comes. And then it's sending different signals to most of the brain areas. So that's a different kind of perspective on it. And this kind of, we've done this with different protocols, and it's been replicated many times, and even meta-analysis has been written now. So this is a very real, real find.
Yes, thank you. I can actually attest personally to that. A couple of years ago, we had an earthquake in Victoria. I am in Melbourne, in Australia. It wasn't huge. It was sort of minor on the Richter scale, but it was felt. And what happened, I got up in the morning. It was on either Saturday or Sunday morning. I've never been in an earthquake before in my life. So I didn't have any reference point or even any memory, but I felt something very strange. And a thought came to my mind, there is an earthquake coming. And within, I would say, 10, 15 seconds, I heard what sounded like a jumbo jet was about to land on the street. It was so, my heart told me. And I didn't have any reference points from and any past memory of an earthquake. So my brain must have interpreted the signal from the heart as a thought, there is an earthquake coming, which given my location, I mean, we don't get, it's not an earthquake prone area by any means. So it was very unusual. And yet it was absolutely accurate and true because a few seconds later, boom, a thunder came through and scared everyone.
I live in California, so I'm pretty familiar with what you're talking about. You know, and everyone has all three types of intuitions that I was talking about. And they can overlap, right? I mean, you can have the energetic sensitivity and the non-local helping, you know, I mean, you're near Melbourne, you said, so I'll tell you another story here. After we published some of our first studies on intuition, you know, and that we could measure this effect, I was contacted who at that time, this is back in the mid-90s, a guy named Murray Gillen from the Australian School of Entrepreneurship. And I thought you might like a local story. He was the dean of the School of Entrepreneurship there. And he reached out to me and said, you know, Roman, we've been studying these characters. He calls them characters. I guess that's a term you guys use down there. We've been studying these characters for years, these serial into entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And we've got cohorts at MIT and, you know, Oxford and blah, 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 and, you know, here in location. And he said the number one characteristic that the serial entrepreneurs, the guys that are good at it time after time, report is they use their intuition when making the final decision. I mean, of course, they look at the spreadsheets and the opportunities, but when a rubber meets the road, they rely on their intuition. And then he said the second most common, that was 80% across all these different entrepreneurs around the world that they'd studied. And he said the second most common characteristic is they have a sense of wanting to give back to those that help them be successful and to their communities. He said, but we want to use your methods to see if we can measure a difference in these repeat entrepreneurs versus risk avoidant types, you know, a bunch of accountants and things. And we ended up publishing a few papers together, and I would say we're successful in doing that over the years.
Wow.
So anyway, I'll give you a local story there.
Thank you for sharing. And in fact, I was going to say that when we have an inner conflict, say my heart says this and my mind says that, for example, when we need to make a decision, the question is, what shall we do? And in that story, you have effectively answered the question, because someone might ask, well, do I try to reconcile my heart and my mind about this issue, what I want to do? With perhaps coherence, and I would like to get to that exercise in a bit, or just disregard the mind and go with the heart, which means effectively to go with my intuition. And when I talk to people, say when I work with my coaching clients, I usually ask them, so what do you think about this? And I immediately say, how does it feel? And I had a number of people who said to me, well, what's the difference? Think and feel to me is the same. And they were men, incidentally, because they were all in their head. So the objective was to reconnect them with their heart feelings and note and being able to notice the difference between the two. So this dovetails very, very nicely with what you have just said. Any thoughts on that?
I do, actually. And thank you for asking that and talking about it. It's something I would talk a lot about in our various training programs that we do. So the way I would often approach this, Anna, is we can invite all the listeners here now to just think back over the past few days, week, couple weeks, whatever, if there was something that came up where you might have been asked to do something, or you know, wanted to do something, maybe it was buy something, or had a relationship challenge or issue. You know, so your mind's thinking about it and so on and so on. And you kind of, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. Or I'm going to, you know, maybe you got an email you don't like and you write your response, right? And you're ready to, you know, give it to them. But there's this deeper inner voice or sense that comes in and goes, probably not the right decision. Or are you sure you want to do that? Or, you know, could even be clearer. But we also have to remember the three types of intuition. There's also the first type. That's really about the mind referencing, and without some practice, it can be confusing which type we're talking about. But I'm getting off track. So what I'm saying is a good analogy of mind and heart talking to each other and having completely different perspectives. So then I would invite you to the people thinking about this, the times that you've had that happen and you went with the mind. Because our vanity is what they want. Right. And we often can pretty much brush this heart stuff away. Then think back, how did that turn out? And I can certainly talk to myself here how many times in my life I've done that and had the awareness of, God, I wish I'd followed that inner guidance, that inner signal.
Yeah.
You know, and it can also be that you said something mean to someone or did something, you know, maybe even accidentally, and you get that inner prompting to go call them.
Yeah.
Or talk to them or clean it up, but we don't follow through on it.
I call it an emotional hangover.
There you go. why I wanted to talk a little bit more about this, Anna, is that I believe, and well, it's more than believe, but I would suggest, let me put it this way, that this lack of alignment between the heart and mind, because it's really a synergistic relationship. It's not one good, one bad. It's the joint venture that but when we don't have that communication between the two in equal balance, that it is the number one source of stress on the planet for people. It is the main source of stress for people.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why we teach so much here in HeartMath about coherence training and emotional management and getting the heart and brain aligned.
Can we do this now? Right. This little exercise, please?
Sure.
To create coherence.
Sure.
Between heart and mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a number of techniques for this, and each with their own purpose. But I'll do one that a technique that you can use anywhere, anytime. Now, this is designed. This takes a little bit of practice to do it in real time, but I'll take you through the steps. But this is something that with practice you can do with your eyes open. It's really meant to be while you're having a conversation with somebody or in a meeting, and it's called shift and lift. Step one is called heart-focused breathing. Focus your attention in the area of the heart. Imagine your breath is flowing in and out of your heart or chest area. Breathing a little slower and deeper than usual. Find a rhythm that's comfortable, that's easy and comfortable. You're literally putting your focus of attention right here in the center of your chest and pretending you're breathing. Now, that's important for energetic reasons. And when I say breathe slow, a little slower and deeper, and I don't want people counting because that keeps you stuck in the head, but it's going to be a rhythm that's going to be around 4 or 5 seconds on the in-breath and 4 or 5 seconds on the out-breath, equal. You don't want a breath hold in between. It's a nice, easy breathing rhythm. And that's our natural resonant frequency. That's another topic, but so we want to use the breath and breathe at the body's natural resonant frequency between the neural connections between the heart, brain, and lungs. So that's heart-focused breathing. Step two, as you do the heart-focused breathing, continue that. Activate feelings of kindness, appreciation, genuine connection, or an attitude of deep listening. So you actually want to breathe that one of those feelings. Again, this is a technique if you're in a meeting or a conversation. So you might just breathe appreciation, the feeling of appreciation, or kindness, depending upon the context, or it could be a genuine connection. So just practice breathing those feelings as you're doing the heart-focused breathing, one of those feelings. And then the next and the last step is radiate those heart qualities or heart frequencies to raise your vibration and help lift the energy field environment that surrounds you. So you're actually radiating those, that appreciation or that kindness. And remember, I talked earlier about how the heart radiates a magnetic field that carries information that interacts with and measurably affects others. So when we add intention to that, it amplifies the power of that too.
Thank you. It's very simple and extremely effective. I actually find myself whenever I do this, because I'm familiar with this exercise, whenever I do this, I find myself smiling when I connect, when I evoke those positive emotions of love, compassion, gratitude, appreciation, forgiveness. I smile without thinking that I'm smiling. I just can't help but smile. Thank you. It's really, really beautiful and very, very powerful. In fact, I can mention that this morning, just before we started the recording, I got some fairly jittering news. Nothing serious, but upsetting a bit. And so I did this exercise to calm down the stress and start radiating positive emotions as opposed to nervousness and stress and anxiety for a few minutes, and it helped. It worked like a charm. So most people, in fact, are familiar, I believe, with just the first step to switch from the sympathetic nervous system to parasympathetic, so to calm anxiety, nerves. And I believe that this is a technique that you teach people like emergency first responders.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the first step called heart-focused breathing, you can just use that step and get a lot of benefit, but there's a lot more benefit by going to the next step. And probably one of that, the technique I read through there was just called shift and lift. Which is a little more specifically designed for, like I was saying, when you're interacting with someone or in a meeting, these types of things. And you, with practice, you can do this with your eyes open. Nobody needs to know you're even doing it. And it's if you play with it, I think people would find it's an amazing the difference it can make. In a lot of school teachers, for example, always often talk about how when they shift their state in coherence, the classroom, yeah, the whole classroom changes, right? Without, yes, even saying anything.
Yeah.
But the technique is probably the most well-known in the public, the people who haven't gone through one of our more in-depth training. It's called quick coherence, and that adds kind of a version of step two. But the technique that we teach in some of our more advanced programs is called attitude breathing. And it's like if somebody is really suffering from trauma, it's a more appropriate technique because it doesn't ask you just to go to appreciation or something like that. But it uses heart-focused breathing as the first step. Then it goes through a process, but to help you find the appropriate replacement attitude or feeling. So, for example, if you're feeling impatient, you can actually breathe the feeling of patience. All right, breathe that feeling, and it takes you past. You're absolutely right, Anna, when you talk about it, that it downregulates the autonomic nervous system, say the sympathetic system, and that's awesome. I think of that a lot of time as my grandma's wisdom. Right, you're a little kid, and you fall down, and you're screaming and crying. But grandma picks you up, and once you make sure you're not hurt and blood's not squirting out or something, grandma do breathe, honey, breathe. Come on, breathe with me, because until you take the intensity out of that, you can't hear anything. You can't, you're just incoherent. So that the breathing can take the does in fact take the intensity out. It might be fear or anxiety, as you were saying, Anna. Or overwhelm, whatever, but you're still left with that emotion, just at a lower level, right? Whether it's fear, anxiety, worry, looping worry, whatever. And those are still causing the same hormonal patterns to be running through our system. It's still draining energy. So learning how to get a hold of that, this is really inner technology, I would say, that inner knob to shift the frequency into an emotion that adds energy rather than depleting. Whether that's breathing neutral or breathing a feeling of ease or calm or appreciation or love. You know, I talk a lot about the spectrum, the frequency spectrum of love.
What is love?
Well, okay. That's like, what is consciousness, right? I mean, people have been arguing for a long time and still are to come up
in
with
200 words or less.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's many kinds of love. There's the love that we experience as humans, right? The love we have for a spouse or a child for their parent. Love of community, love of country, right? Love of God for some people. You know, these are all different qualities of love. And then, you know, as we evolve, from my perspective, in our awareness and consciousness, in our literally in our vibration of our consciousness, that evolves into what a lot of people would call unconditional love,
yeah,
right? And that gets us into what I call the higher vibrational spectrum of love. And I have the position that love, the big game love, is intelligence. Love is the intelligent information that actually organize the universe and all that's in it. So it's love is, you know, so I say we can't just pin it down to what is love. But I mean, to me, the love is the intelligent information, whether we're breathing those frequencies. And so when I talk about the vibrational spectrum of love, I think of love and as an octave. You could think of it as a musical octave with the different notes in an octave. Very similar, and I mean this when I say vibrational spectrum, I really do mean it. My real background is emotional physiology, right? And emotions, we can talk about the nervous system and hormones of emotion and all that, and I do, but ultimately what sets those hormones and nervous system activity and so on in motions happens at the energetic or the vibrational level, that part of our undivided wholeness. And as people become more self-aware and actually practice, and it's especially men, it takes a little more practice, you know, a little more heart vulnerability, but we can start to feel these things vibrationally in our energetic system and have our own experience, be a self-scientist of what I'm saying. And it's a lot easier to find that inner knob I was talking about to shift these frequencies at the vibrational level before they get set in motion biochemically in our nervous system, right? But so if we think back to the vibrational spectrum of love, you know, high up in that spectrum of the frequencies is compassion, right? Kindness, heart vulnerability, patience, a really important one that exists at the level of our larger self, as well as higher dignity.
Acceptance,
exactly. Higher dignity, acceptance, inner peace, respect, forgiveness, wholeness care would be all the different frequencies that make up that octave or that vibrational spectrum of love.
Yeah. And speaking of which, I always feel that when someone says, I care about you or something, someone else, so to care about another consciousness, another individual, is just pure, unconditional love.
Yeah, or care.
I care about the planet.
Yeah.
I care about animals. I care about you. So care might be just a different word for love in this context.
I would say that care, true care, is love in action.
Yes.
Right? Because it's fine to feel these things,
yeah.
Right? And we need to, because that is what raises our vibration and connects us with our larger self. I mean, because this is really, consciousness is about the vibration of our consciousness. So practicing appreciation, these types of things, feeling them, and even if you can't feel them, breathing the attitude of them is helping to connect. It opens that door, that channel to our larger self. And that opens that flow of intuitive guidance, which is what raises our consciousness and our awareness. And which I think we all would say is what humanity needs most right now.
Absolutely.
Then we're also radiating that into our field environment, which we can measure as vibrational frequency patterns. I mean, we can measure the frequencies being carried by the field I was talking about earlier, Anna, and tell with about 75% accuracy what somebody's feeling. Right. So when I'm talking about these as vibrational frequencies, they really are, right? And we are able to start measuring these in that magnetic domain now, in that energetic domain. So in terms of our own health, you know, because when we talk about heart coherence, which is what naturally takes us into that state of coherence, is when we experience kindness and compassion and appreciation and love. And that is an optimal state. We now, hundreds of studies now of showing this, that heart coherence is a state that facilitates our body's own natural regenerative processes. So for our own health and healing, recovering from trauma, connecting with that larger self, it takes us to that more objective place, more vitality, you know, more harmony within the body's internal systems. So even if you don't care about others, do it for yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And this is, in fact, a very nice segue to my next point, which I would like to raise, coming back to the heart itself for a moment. I would like to bring it up because I feel it is really important for everyone to understand. When someone has a heart attack, it may be triggered directly by a physiological condition, but I believe that there is always an emotional underlying cause. And we know that someone can get a sudden, so-called sudden heart attack and die with no physiological issues, in perfect health, and doctors can't find the cause. While in other cases, there is a deteriorating health over a period of time, and that eventually brings about a heart attack. And in those cases, the emotional impact is on the physiology of the body. So whether it is high cholesterol causing blockages, high blood pressure, and many other heart and body conditions. People often get heart attack in highly stressful situations like painful divorce, loss of a loved one, loss of job. When we are overwhelmed with negative emotions, including guilt, shame, grief, or just losing motivation to live. And the name of this medical episode, heart attack, I think it's very revealing, because the heart attacks itself and the body. So my question is the heart so intelligent and so sensitive that it can decide to attack itself? And also, does the heart serve as a quick exit mechanism when we are done with this incarnation?
Well, there's several questions wrapped into one there. In terms of your last question, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I would say that really comes from our larger self, though, you know, which knows, okay, if it's time to go, you know, and the heart shuts off, well, that's it, right? I mean, just like that first spark of the heartbeat, you know, comes from the larger self, the spirit level. So does the end of life and the end of the heart. You know, unless we got in an accident or something, but I mean, in terms of a, now you were talking about heart attacks, and I probably should distinguish that there's a different, a lot of times it's actually what's called sudden cardiac death, and which is very different than a heart attack, although it's almost always called the same thing, a heart attack. Sudden cardiac death is often, like you actually alluded to this, there's no structural heart problem or disease. And this is typically an arrhythmic death. And this is the type of sudden cardiac death is what's often associated with negative emotions. You got really emotionally upset, these types of things. And it's really the brain sending too many signals down. The physiology of it's pretty well known, that if you over stimulate the sympathetic system in the right way at the right time, it can trigger an arrhythmia, which is the type of an arrhythmia that leads to sudden cardiac death. So that's one type. And there's actually more, I think, a few years ago, since I looked at statistics, but it's hundreds of thousands of deaths in the U.S. a year are actually sudden cardiac death. Heart attack, on the other hand, by definition, is when the arteries of the arteries that feed blood flow to the heart muscle itself become clogged. And, you know, and cholesterol gets blamed on that as clogging the arteries. Although a lot of my friends and colleagues who are part of the original high cholesterol research from way back when argue pretty strongly and convincingly that cholesterol is not the problem. It's inflammation. It's the inflammation that when you inflame, you get inflammatory areas within the arteries that it then starts collecting and building up the plaque. But we blame the wrong thing, right? The real causal thing is inflammation. And the inflammation is ultimately, for many people, caused by long-term mismanaged emotions, what we call chronic stress.
Yes, yes. Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted you to say. Thank you.
Yeah, but it's the chronic stress that's leading to excess cortisol and inflammatory processes, right? So over long time periods, you know, it's the cynical personality, the cynicism and hostility and anger, frustration. These are the things that lead, these are the lower vibrational emotions that have a depleting effect. And because any emotion we experience with any intensity sets in motion thousands of biochemicals, you know, the downstream effects of those. So the, you know, like anger, especially intense things like hostility or cynical personalities, whereas cynicism, you're just always negative in that perspective. You're constantly flooding the system with the biochemistry that leads to inflammation and downregulates immunity. Whereas when we're in a vibrational, energetically speaking, and in those higher vibrations, you know, compassion, kindness, appreciation, right, that we were talking about, those love, those qualities of love, that sets in motion a very different biochemical set of hormones and biochemicals that add energy and are protective. They downregulate inflammatory processes and upregulate immunity. I mean, this is well known. This is not some theory here. I mean, this is well established, what we're talking about.
Yes, it is scientifically well established, but in my experience, many people are not aware of that. And we have just very nicely closed the loop to say that, effectively coming back to our starting point, that heart-brain coherence can effectively save our life and prolong our life and keep us healthy with those higher emotions that produce different hormones, etc., etc. So there's a flow-on effect on the whole system. So would you agree, well, I know that you would agree, that a frequent practice of consciously inducing heart-brain coherence plus in the long-term meditation practice can prolong our life, keep us healthier, and ultimately maybe even save our life?
Oh, absolutely. And I would add happier and more at peace and more secure within ourselves as we connect more with our larger self. So yes.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It's truly for so many people, Anna, that we hear that get into the heart math or whatever about heart math, but get into some type of learning to follow their heart, whatever that system is, and get their heart coherence, that it's transformational. I mean, some of my favorite things in our training programs, so like there was one that just happened in a course I'm teaching now, a 7-week course through a program here in the U.S., that we debriefed, you know, from their homework. And just in this last class, a lady got on and, you know, just, I'm just so excited. Your heart really does talk to you. She had actually done the practices and discovered the difference between the head and heart for the first time, that realization. And it was such a profound thing for her to have had the heart come online and, you know, to start having that dialogue with her larger self.
Yes. And those programs, those courses are still available via your website, yes?
Well, yes. We have a lot. Well, primarily the courses we teach here now are courses that allow others to become certified to teach heart math in many different ways, in organizations or in healthcare providers. We have a program for trauma that's open to the public, as well as people who focus in helping people recover from trauma. Then we also have a lot of free resources for just the general public. And a really good one, it's a 90-minute video that's broken into the smaller chunks. It's called the HeartMath Experience. So it's a great free resource for people that just want to learn some of these techniques. And just go to the heartmath.org, you know, .org. I need to keep saying that because people always put in .com.
Oh, yeah.
I can find those resources. And there's also a research library. If people are science-minded, there's hundreds of the scientific publications and papers that can be downloaded for free there as well. We also have a number of apps, smartphone apps, that allow people to see their own heart coherence and learn about it in real time. One of those is called the, if you're, you were telling me earlier that your audience is a kind of a more mature audience. I don't necessarily mean older, but I mean kind of spiritually more aware. One of our apps for that community is called the Global Coherence app. And this is a free app that allows you to, you can actually use your phone's camera as the sensor to measure your pulse, your heartbeat, and measures your heart rate variability and how coherent the rhythm is. It's really designed to feed back your own level of personal coherence, but it also allows us to look at the collective coherence of the community. It's called the Global Coherence app because it's part of that, our Global Coherence project, which is bringing people together, you know, oftentimes in synchronized events, but anytime, to add more love and compassion to the planetary energetic field with the intention of lifting the baseline consciousness of humanity. So it's really an app to help us, the community that comes together, to help add more love and compassion to the global field. So it might be an app that would be appropriate for your audience, Anna.
Yes, thank you. It is so absolutely critical for us to minimize as much as possible those negative emotions of fear, anger, stress, and anxiety consciously, by being aware that this is what we are broadcasting into the quantum field from our electromagnetic field. And that's something that we do have control of at the individual level.
Yes, but people need tools. They need to know how to do that.
Yes. So now, hopefully, everyone listening to this podcast and to many other of your presentations and learning more about your work will have those tools and strategies, and people can pursue training if they want to. Well, Roland, before we close, and this has been an amazing conversation, so I am hugely grateful. It has exceeded my expectations. Before I ask you for your final thoughts, I would like to ask you one specific question, which, in fact, could be your final thought. If there was just one thing you could change in the world in an instant, what would it be?
The real answer to that would be dissolving the separation between the head and heart. However, I also know, and I'm wise enough to know, that would be cheating the game, because Earth is an advanced system that we have the honor of coming to as beings to learn about emotions and evolve our consciousness through lifetimes. You can't just flip the switch like that and do that.
But if you could.
Yeah, that's what it would be. But it would also be cheating the game, I mean, so to speak.
Okay, that's an interesting viewpoint.
Yeah.
So you still feel we need to go through what we are going through.
Yeah. Yeah. So my parting thought would be to invite anyone listening to just do your best to remember to pause throughout the day. And just simply ask yourself, do an inner check, and just simply ask yourself, what am I feeding the field? Am I feeding my personal field environment? Because it does connect with the global field, the Earth's energetic. We didn't get into that today, but we're measuring that as well through different ways. Am I feeding the field feelings of appreciation, kindness, forgiveness? Am I extending compassionate latitude to others? Or am I feeding the field vibrations of anxiety, fear, frustration, impatience? And if you find you're feeding the field one of those lower vibrations, because what we feed the field matters in measurable ways, find that inner knob and your inner technology and take a few heart-focused breaths, make a shift, and shift your own internal vibration, and feed the field more, one of those higher vibrations out of the spectrum of love, whatever that might be and whatever is appropriate for that moment.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Roland. I really appreciate your time and all your insights and this beautiful conversation. It's been such a pleasure to have you on Quantum Living.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you. That's all for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I would much appreciate if you could spare a moment and post a review on Apple Podcasts or on my website at quantumlivingpodcast.com, where you can also read the full show notes, guest info, reviews, and more. I'm your host, Anna Anderson. I look forward to connecting with you in the next episode of Quantum Living. Until then, keep your vibrations high and be well.